just before I came back, somebody asked me a question about mix class and whether that is continuing. And I believe I heard him say he that his group was going to continue. Does anybody else know who's been involved in his like once a week evening study group? All right. I think that's my guess. But if you want to, you can email me and I'll connect you with him so that he can answer that question. All right. Well, welcome everyone. Let me go around and say hi, starting with Phil, Bob K, Bob O, right next door in my screen, Alex, Etsido, Andy, Michael, Catherine, Cody, Linda B, Marv, Paulette, Karen, Choketsu, Pat, Vin, Aaron, Randy, Joan, Soon, Erica, Amelia, Mark, Linda R, and you probably can't hear me yet, but Paul. Hello, Paul. I think I caught everybody. There was some shifting around of the screen in the middle there, so apologies if not. All right. So announcements. I'm imagining most of you are aware, but we do have a weekly email newsletter which updates you on stuff. And if for some reason you are not subscribed to that and you want to be, you can just go to our website and there's a little like sign up for our newsletter button and you give our give your information and you can get that. So everything that I'm talking about is mentioned in there. But we have sadly postponed our Zendo reopening date because I don't know, it was like a group of us got together, senior students at Bright Way, and we were all like, feeling kind of iffy about it. And then the next day, I encountered a message from our local Health Sciences University, which projected, a severe shortage of hospital beds by Labor Day if we continue on the trajectory we're on. So begging everybody, vaccinated or not, to limit indoor activities. So I was like, that was the clincher. So, we're still preparing for that. And, once cases are declining again and whatever, then we'll be ready to go. But if you are in the area, we are going to have in the an in-person option for our retreat, August retreat, 23rd through the 28th. So I felt like that was kind of like a consolation prize that, if a small handful of us, I think it's not going to be more than about a total of maybe five or six people in the Zendo, and that's a consistent group throughout the week. And sometimes there might even be two or three of us in the Zendo, but we'll also be hooked up in the Zendo via Zoom, so you can participate via online from afar or nearby if you prefer not to be in person at this point. So look at that, sign up for a retreat, and it's not necessary to register for retreat if you are going to be participating online, unless you just want to let me know, what your intention is. I'm going to be there these days or this time of day, which is nice. If you do want to stop by in person, even if it's just part-time or on occasion, then you do need to register, just because then we want to limit that participation to probably a maximum of 10 people. So do register if you would like to stop by the Zendo. And let's see, there's also term student program beginning in September. So check out the email newsletter and website for that. Oh, and Tuesday, like the Tuesday class during the retreat. So it starts on Monday the 23rd, Monday evening. And then so Tuesday the 24th, we won't have a class. But if you join us on Tuesdays, join us for sitting, the Tuesday schedule will just be folded into the retreat schedule and we won't have a class. So just be aware of that. But it won't affect any Sunday activities because it ends on Saturday morning. All right. Any questions or other things that people can think of that I should announce? All right. So today's talk, I'm calling The Dharma of Staying Calm When Facing Suffering or Difficulty. So when we, like I said, when we can't avoid facing suffering or stress, or we don't want to avoid it, what does the Dharma offer us in terms of preventing anxiety and fear and overwhelm, burnout, depression, just, ah. So we'll talk about what it means to stay calm. Why would we want to stay calm? And a little bit about how we do that. But first, let us take a moment to bear witness. So this is a practice of momentarily setting aside questions of what to do and what we can do to address suffering, but just opening ourselves up to it, taking a few deep breaths, centering ourselves and our bodies, acknowledging we are intimately connected with all life. We turn our attention to the wildfires raging across our planet, bearing witness to the loss of lives, human and non-human. Bearing witness to the loss of homes, farms, livelihoods, forests, cultural resources. Bearing witness to the fear and panic and grief of those who must leave everything behind to flee the flames. Bearing witness to the firefighters making superhuman efforts in extreme heat and dangerous conditions. Although at this moment, we may not see a way to help, we open our hearts and minds to the reality of this suffering, because it is always better to face the truth. And because we do not want these many beings to be alone in their suffering. May human beings find a way to live in harmony with nature and with each other, and to restore the bounty and resilience of the earth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha parajna paramita. Thank you. If any of you don't know that little piece we say at the end, all Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, it's in our chant book, which you can find on the website. And it's just this little phrase that, like, when we're doing chants, when we're doing services, that's like somebody might be reciting something, but then when it comes to that part, we all join in. And it's just this, it's a kind of, you know, so then we all, I don't know if you're familiar with Catholic Mass or anything, right? This is the part where, like, then we all say our piece and chime in. So I, if you want to participate in that, you know, check that out on the website, and you might, you know, print it out or something and say that along with us. So I'm calling this the Dharma of staying calm. And when we say in practice, the Dharma of, Dharma means teaching, could be the Buddhist teaching, a teaching, or the truth of. So Dharma means teaching or truth. So when we say, you know, the Dharma of, we're referring to several different things. The Buddhist teachings on the topic, the Buddhist, and then, but also like the teaching of the topic. When we start to explore calm, or we try to practice calm, what does it teach us? What teaching is inherent in this subject? And also the truth of it. So we're exploring the Dharma of calm. So why do we want to stay calm? And I figured it's kind of helpful to explore, well, what's the opposite of calm? So as I love to do, I looked up some antonyms of calm: agitated, nervous, troubled, upset, excitable, excessive, immoderate. So that wasn't all the antonyms, but some of the ones that seem relevant to me. And, you know, some of the responses that seem like the opposite of calm are natural. We have responses of anger that arise. Anger is, we have a sense that something needs to be protected, right? So anger arises. We have a sense of worry arise. It's telling us we might need to plan for something. We might need to prepare. Agitation, you know, is an excited state that gets us ready for quick reaction. As we evolved, you know, as everybody knows, you know, we have a small repertoire of reactions to what we encounter in life, and that's fight or flight or freeze. So those are kind of the natural selection bred options. But as Robert Wright discusses in Why Buddhism is True, one of my favorite books, and I think many people in the Sangha agree with me there. It's an evolutionary psychologist who discusses, you know, why did we end up the way we are, and how can Buddhism help us with that? He points out that natural selection led to certain outcomes which maximized the survival and reproduction of our ancestors. But actually, at this point, these things are not necessarily adaptive. They're not necessarily about us perceiving the truth, and they're not necessarily helpful in our modern circumstances. So, especially in our complicated lives, given our intelligence, we can be upset. As many people have talked about this, we can be upset by something happening on the other side of the world. I've heard a lot of people mention, you know, being really distressed this week about what's happening in Afghanistan. You know, we can conceive of this place, and we have information about this place, and we can be upset by what is happening. We can be upset by things that might happen. We can be upset by complex interpretations of and narratives about what's happening and our relationship to it. What does it say about us? We can be upset by how we should have responded to a situation in the past, we can be upset by our worries, not just about what might happen in the future, but about our capacity to respond. So, I mean, our ability to get upset, to anticipate, to worry, to be stressed, to be troubled is much greater than that of our ancient ancestors. So the stresses never end. So basically, if our fight, flight, and freeze responses last more than a few moments, run, there's a tiger. They actually negatively impact our decision-making. They negatively impact the clarity of our perception, our ability to respond, our emotional well-being, our physical health. So this is something, you know, this is a reality that, you know, Buddhism didn't put it exactly in these terms, but Buddhism has always said, and then modern psychology and modern research is also proving to be the case. So because of all these negative impacts, this is part of why we seek diversions, entertainments, distractions, whatever takes our mind off of these concerns, whether those concerns are personal or about the greater world. And there's a time and a place for this, of course. Taking a break, enjoying ourselves, putting everything aside, just whatever. But this is a temporary solution. Because the sources of our stress remain. So we kind of have to keep occupied all the time. Or the anxiety, the fear, the overwhelm, the depression, whatever can start creeping back in. And, you know, many of the people here might think, like, you may not think you're all that great at coping with this stuff, at facing this stuff, at being still with this stuff, but really, like, I would say a huge proportion of the population, if you said, all right, now sit there for 30 minutes, don't move, don't read anything, don't watch anything, don't do anything, just be alone with your body and mind, they would think that sounded like torture. So the fact that we can even do that, regardless of how well we think we do it, is a significant thing. So when we seek relief through distraction and diversion, there's also a cost. When we avoid bearing witness to situations that cause stress or suffering, whether that is to ourselves, or to others, to a loved ones, or in the wider world. We also avoid intimacy. And grief is love when it meets loss. So if we're cutting off our grief, we have to cut off our love at the same time. So there's a cost. There's a sense that we're living kind of compartmentalizing things, living in some denial, cutting ourselves off from part of our experience as human beings. So calm, what does it mean to stay calm, and why is calm a good thing? So calm can mean peaceful and serene. And sometimes what we're talking about today can be like that. And I think most of us would like more of that in our lives. But the calm we're looking for can't be limited to times we can be, and these are some synonyms for calm: placid, slow, tranquil, at a standstill. So that's lovely, you know, at times we can feel that way, perhaps. But that's not the nature of our lives all the time, is placid. So another meaning of calm, which I think gets a little closer to what we're talking about, is composed. And composed has synonyms like level-headed, relaxed, unflappable, collected, patient, and poised. So there are negative connotations of calm as well, which I would argue we are not looking for in our practice, because these are outcomes of the turning away from our interdependence and connection with life. So we'll feel less troubled. So it's kind of a self-centered use, perhaps, of spiritual practice or whatever method we're using. So we don't feel so troubled. Impassivity, quiescence, disinterested, unconcerned. From a Buddhist point of view, if this is the flavor of our calm, we've achieved it through a denial of reality. The reality that we are interdependent with all things, everything is impermanent, like life inevitably includes suffering, like we're so if there's a coldness to our calm, then that's not quite it. So the calm we're looking for is not a static, removed, or conditional thing. It doesn't require us to avoid life, doesn't require us to be sitting quietly on a lakeshore or a zendo, although these things are very nice. It doesn't require us to stay carefully absorbed in the pleasant aspects of life so that we don't have to deal with the suffering. If we want to be able to maintain some sense of stability, centeredness, and perspective when facing difficulty, when facing the unknown, the reality of impermanence, this is what we're looking for, to be composed. So that even if we're momentarily buffeted by things that make us feel angry or worried or anxious, we're able to stay composed because we still maintain a connection to our kind of spiritual and physical center of gravity. So we have a sense that we will regain our composure. We'll be okay again soon. So I think of one of those weighted dolls that when you push it over, you know, it rights itself. So yeah, I mean, we're not trying to stay still like this, but when something pushes us, we're like, okay, because there's a centeredness that will bring us back, and that we learn to trust that. So it doesn't mean we don't experience emotions, it doesn't mean we never get upset, but we don't, I you know, the, to use the kind of culture term, we don't lose it. What is it? You know, there's different ways to phrase it. We don't lose it. We don't lose ourselves, our groundedness, our perspective, whatever. One of my favorite experiences of this is what I've mentioned it many times, but my experience of Ki Society Aikido. And what in that teaching, we talked about not letting the mind be led. So we wanted mind and body to be coordinated, and that what often happens when something happens, a challenge comes at us, we see something, we anticipate something, our mind is led. Our mind starts to be controlled by that, and we lose that coordination, that we're anticipating, tensing up, we're sensing opposition, we're bracing ourselves. And if we can stay coordinated instead, this has real, real results. It's not even just about like a perspective or emotion. It's like in the real world, this has real, real tangible results. And the calm, I thought this was very interesting. So they use different visualizations in Aikido to help you, you know, access this coordination. And one of them is they see calm stillness as being infinitely fast motion. So if you imagine there being a wave, right? And a, you know, here's a wave, and the faster the wave goes, pretty soon you cannot detect any motion at all. And yet that's like infinitely fast motion. That is energy. That is potential. That's not dead stillness. So the stillness can have energy to it. So another way to describe what's going on here, calm, the calm that we would like to be able to cultivate in our lives versus the lack of calm, I am describing it as operating with a sense of small self against the world compared to operating with a sense of boundless self with the world. So small self against the world is our usual mode of operating, and a boundless self with the world, I feel, describes this other way of operating. So the small self against the world means our usual limited sense of ourselves, our bodies, how we're defined in relationship, social position, possessions, capacities, plans, interests, opinions, activities, etc. And natural selection gave us this mode of operating. It's about protecting and looking out for the interests of this individual, or my, you know, my offspring or mates or something, right? And this is an expedient mode, one that narrows our perceptions to a source of potential threat or advantage and propels us to fight, flight, or freeze. If you want to think about it, it's nature's shortcut. As Robert Wright so beautifully explains in Why Buddhism Is True, natural selection didn't care. It's not like it had a plan, but right, it didn't, you might say it didn't care if our perceptions are true or that they made us happy people or anything. All that mattered was, did it get us to act in such a way that it increased our survival and reproduction? So do we need to be constrained by this mode of operation that natural selection bred into us? And we often think it's small self against the world is the only way, but it's a limited way. The one that denies other aspects of reality, other dimensions of reality, as I talked about last week. It denies interdependence. It denies emptiness. It denies suchness. So this small mode of operating also leads easily and inevitably to stress, anxiety, fear, overwhelm, burnout, depression, despair. I mean, what's the small self against the world anyway? We are so tiny. We are so limited and so imperfect. Even if we're energetic and capable, how much can we really do, especially in the face of impermanence? We can't control other individuals, let alone societies or other nations. No matter how much planning we do, no matter how cautious we are, everything can be undone in a moment. Living only in a small self against the world way is a recipe for stress. But fortunately, there is another way. So operating in boundless self with the world mode, what is that about? So there's a reality to that small, limited self, but the boundless self is a bigger perspective that doesn't deny the small self. So it's like, you know, here's the small self, which is oblivious of all that. But the boundless self includes everything. So it's not a holier way of viewing things. It's just bigger. And I'm going to argue less stressful and more effective. Boundless self is not separate from the world. It's not separate from what's happening. It's not separate from other people. It's not separate from the challenges we're facing. It doesn't try to cut itself off or maintain fixed territory and prevent change or certain kinds of change or force other kinds of change. Boundless self is ready to be changed. It's not afraid of being changed because change is inevitable. Boundless self relies on its natural capacity, which may or may not be able to ensure certain outcomes in the future. But there's only so much we can do about that. We can calmly take care of what we can take care of in this moment with some mindfulness about what might happen in the future. But ultimately, it's like, well, you know, I made my preparations. Now we'll see what happens. Boundless self doesn't get caught in ideas about how such and such shouldn't be happening. How could this be happening? This is so terrible. Why is this happening to me? How could this be happening? Because it's not trying to maintain some kind of fixed idea or narrative about us, about a limited small self. It's just, it's responding to what is, and responds as skillfully as possible. And I would say, among many other things I could say, boundless self is not afraid of having its heart broken, because that's the cost of being alive. So if we can operate with more of a sense of boundlessness of self, in terms of space and time, if we can center ourselves along that independent dimension of reality I was talking about last week, while remaining open to the dependent dimension, everything flows a whole lot better and with much less stress. No matter what comes at us, no matter what we're facing, we don't have to lose our sense of calm and composure. I mean, we do, of course, realistically, right? But it's that weighted doll thing again, right? Ooh, lost it. Okay, but there's a calm in the sense that we know we will return to that uprightness. So all of this sounds, hopefully, sounds great, but operating with a sense of boundless self takes practice. Our instincts, bred into us by natural selection, actually tells us we had better not let go of that small self against the world mode, because shit's going to hit the fan if that happens. Everything is going to fall apart. It's going to be terrifying. We're going to die. Terrible things are going to happen. So we're actually like part of that small self. We're actually, you know, resistant to letting that go. So how do we cultivate more of a sense of a boundless self with the world? Before we get into detailed practices, I want to point out that in Zen and Buddhism, we treat symptoms and the disease. So we treat symptoms and the source of those symptoms at the same time. We do both. The symptoms of our limited sense of self are stress and anxiety, fear, overwhelm, burnout, depression, despair, among other things. And we have practices for alleviating these symptoms, which I will get to a couple of them. But the source, the disease of our limited sense of self is a major misunderstanding about the nature of reality. So we also have teachings and practices for correcting this misunderstanding and thereby alleviating symptoms in a lasting and permanent way. So in my opinion, I think much of what has been borrowed from Dharma practice by modern psychology and stuff has been the alleviation of symptoms, which is great. You know, it's lovely, but it really has not, it's not borrowed like, yeah, but what is the disease? What is the misunderstanding that causes those symptoms? And that's not so much, hasn't been taken up so much in a wider sense. But so all the way along in our practice, we treat both symptoms and source. But ultimately, they're not really separate practices. Because as I'm going to talk about, we treat our symptoms by aligning ourselves with the truth in small, physical, immediate ways. We do practices like centering ourselves in our breath or body. Because in doing this, we act for a moment as if we are a boundless self with the world. So whether we've realized or actualized this sense of boundlessness in a conscious way, we're aligning ourselves with that reality and taste some of that calm that we need. And it also informs us, right? So it's kind of, it's not, they're not necessarily separate practices. So for the remainder of my talk, which won't go on too much longer, talking about a couple of practices to alleviate symptoms, viewing them as a way to operate as, for momentarily at least, as a boundless self with the world. So So there's many different practices that do this. And maybe when we open things up for Q&A, if you have one that you want to share, please feel free, because there are formal Buddhist practices that we do to do this, but we can also make practices up. You know, who knows? Whatever works. So people experiment and they try things, maybe saying a certain verse or, you know, touching your heart, or I don't know, like there's many different things that we can do. But I wanted to talk about this, you know, centering ourselves in our breath and body and immediate sensations here and now. And looking at this through this lens of, in what way is this aligning ourselves with this boundless self with the world reality? So doing this sends a message. Modern psychologists are, you know, confirming all of this. It sends a message to our body-mind, body-mind, as not two separate things, that things are okay. Because ordinarily we wouldn't do this. We wouldn't let go of our preoccupation with the small self against the world unless things were okay. Unless we felt like, okay, well, that's fine. I've got it. Everything's under control. I'm safe. So now I can relax. So if we do relax, if we do allow ourselves to just be in the moment, to breathe deeply, we're sending the message to our body and mind that it is okay. At least at the moment, it is okay. So we may, at a given time, be dominated by this sense of self against the world. We need to worry, tense up, anticipate, lash out, and prepare. But then we might realize that, okay, this isn't helping, right? This is like stressing me out, compromising my health, confusing me. So I want to do a practice to cultivate calm. So then we align ourselves with this reality of a boundless self with the world. Our personal drama is not actually under assault. Our personal drama is an interdependent part of the unfolding of the world. Whether we're particularly enjoying this section of our drama or not, this is part of the whole thing. And we can only do what we can do in this moment. Sometimes this moment is preparing for the future, but this can be done calmly. Sometimes this moment requires quick and decisive action. But the more centered we can stay in this moment, the more effective our action will be. Sometimes this moment means enduring a painful emotion or the discomfort of not knowing what to do. But tensing up against that reality is not actually helpful. We have to kind of endure and let it move through, let the situation evolve. And it may be painful, or if we tense up, we're just kind of going to prolong the suffering. And I'm imagining plenty of people have an experience of this. So we do this centering ourselves in the moment, letting go of all those concerns. We do that in our mindfulness practice. We're like, all right, despite everything that's going on, I'm just going to walk. I'm just going to garden. I am just going to wash the dishes. I'm going to pay attention to the immediate sensations. And we're aligning ourselves with this sense in which everything is okay, or as okay as we can make it through willful effort. And we can do this at any moment, just by taking a few deep breaths. And we do this in our zazen. So this really is the central practice of our zazen. Every time we open that hand of thought, we're worrying, we're thinking, we're planning. And whenever we do this, we are training ourselves. We are aligning ourselves with that boundless self, with the world. Even if we don't really believe it or trust it yet, we are practicing that. And we are experiencing what the results of that are. And I would argue that if we are stressed, if we are upset, if we are not calm, the more you sit zazen, the better. Like in terms of time, regularity and time. I would say anywhere between 10 minutes a day to 2 hours a day. More than that, sometimes weird stuff starts to happen, but anywhere between there, like the more we sit, the more we have access to this calm. And it doesn't make any sense. You may not be sitting there having like, oh, this is wonderful meditation, I feel so calm. It doesn't really have to be. We are, when we sit, at the very least, at a physical, literal level, we are setting everything aside. We are sending the message to our being that it is okay. I have space to do this. I have space to put everything down. So it works on us at a subconscious and physical level and whatever. So this is a huge part of it. And I think it's valuable to recognize that, you know, we're treating a symptom by doing these things, but it's also pointing us toward a deeper reality. So another practice I wanted to briefly mention, which is a little bit more formal, if you will, is Tonglen practice. So that is one that the Vajrayana Buddhism created. And I'm not that familiar with the traditional teachings on it, but one way of doing this is because much Vajrayana practice has to do with visualization. So you contemplate suffering, in the world, but it can be your own suffering as well. And you know, this may or may not work for you in every detail, but you visualize this as like a dark smoke. It's a substance, and you breathe it in, and then you breathe out, you know, clean air, I guess. You breathe out purified, you breathe out, you know, peace. You have transformed that suffering into something clean and pure and positive. Now, this may sound like a strange practice, and if we look at it from the point of view of small self against the world, it is a very like strange and counterproductive and stress-producing practice, right? If you're like, okay, I'm going to suck in all the pain and suffering of all the horrible things happening in the world right now, and I'm going to fix them and clean them, and I'll store all the badness inside myself, and I'll find some goodness, and I'll send that out. Like, okay, that's not, you're not going to be able to sustain that very long. And it's not, you can't do that. You don't have an infinite, you know, storage capacity for pain and suffering. So this means this is why this is like, in order to do this, we have to shift into a more of a sense of boundless self with the world. So it's almost more like, you know, that we're breathing in that suffering, recognizing we are not separate from it. We are not separate from it. We are inviting it in. We are letting it in. We are not bracing ourselves against it. We are being one with it. And where does it go? Through us, it goes into nowhere. I had a teacher once suggest, like, okay, well, here's emptiness. Just like, now throw the smoke into the emptiness, and it just goes, you know. Somehow, something greater than us takes care of it. And then, you know, because of our love, because of our interdependence and connection, you know, what we are breathing out, that is what we are breathing out, our love, our response, our sense of interdependence, which again, we do not manufacture, right? It's just a reflection of this. So if anybody knows more about Tonglen practice, feel free to chime in. And I think this is a little related to what I'm trying to do at the beginning of our talks when we do a bearing witness practice to some extent, is like, let's just be with this. Let's expose ourselves to it. Recognize, like, we're not in charge here. We don't have control over this, and yet we naturally want good for beings. And so that's what we send, is a wish and intention for all beings. And that, just as a note, like, we can do that for, like I said, the pain in the greater world, but we can definitely do this for our own pain and stress and challenges as well. So I will leave it there. We have 10 minutes for questions and comments. So if you would like to say something, the easiest thing to do is to click under the reactions button at the bottom of your screen, and you can raise your hand. But you can also do it the old-fashioned way, or if nobody's saying anything, just unmute yourself and chime in. Joan.
Great talk, Domio. You know, the bearing witness and the Tonglen remind me of metta practice. It's almost the same thing. What do you think?
Yeah, that's another one which, yeah, I mean, it's very related. Tonglen has more of that deliberately, you know, kind of looking for the suffering. But metta implies that, right? Metta implies I want you to be free from fear and anxiety, which implies there's some fear and anxiety out there. So yeah, whichever works. Yes, she's okay.
I like the wording that you said, I have the space to do this.
Mm.
That really resonated. Mm. I find that's really significant and important, especially if I think I have a lot to do, just to remind myself, I have the space to do this. I have the space to create the space to be in the space while I'm doing this. Thanks.
I like that. And I find, I think Zazen is incredibly important, like I said, but there are other things that we do that also send our body and mind the same message. And I know for me, if I'm too busy to exercise, that is a bad scenario, right? Because what message does that send to my mind and body? Like, oh my God, we don't even time, you know. But if I just make some space for that, it's not just about physical activity, right? It's affecting me at all these levels, saying, all right, chill out. Like, it's not an emergency. All right. Bob.
I'd like to offer something that I came across recently. And I keep coming across it all the time. And that is that when I have some perception that I'm not doing something right, that I'm not achieving some goal or result that I think I need to be achieving in my sitting or in my daily actions or anytime, to me that's a clear signal that something is coming up that I need to welcome, that I need to say, oh, hi, I've met you before. And what it is, excuse me, what you are is not a bad thing. I just need to look at you. Mm. I just need to appreciate you. And for some reason, that seems to help a lot to pull me out of, I'm not good enough. I'm not doing this right. For some reason, none of it is taking, because here I am again in this quandary. And it, actually, that is just a friendly gesture from beyond, or from now, I guess, that says, hey, wake up, you know, wake up.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Karen, and then so on.
Mine is really similar to what Bob was just saying, that when I have the familiar anxiety over, you know, certain topics that tend to revisit me, I have had a lot of success in just accepting those feelings and not trying to push them away, but just thinking, you know, allowing myself to feel afraid or feel scared or whatever. And then just like similar to what Bob is saying, just what I do is I tell myself, you've been here before, you've had, you know, gone through all these feelings before, you're okay right now, you're safe right now. And just kind of reminding myself that, you know, this is my first pony ride with this, and it almost always turns out to be much better than my fears are running away with. That seems to really help for me. And also keeping a gratitude list, which I kind of go in and out of doing, but when I do keep a gratitude list, it's just amazing. There's so many things in every day to be grateful for. And yeah, it's kind of a good balance, a reality check that there's a lot, in my life anyway, there's a lot more good, a lot more positive than not.
Thank you. And I think it's, you know, the core of this is, again, I love Aikido. I wish, like, I don't know, somehow like Zen and Aikido could just be one practice, but it's non-opposition. As soon as we have an opposition to our own reactions, our own feelings, or to situations in the world, you know, this is like just a recipe for pain and stress, and we can't actually change anything by doing that anyway, right? So it's like this, but in Aikido, that doesn't mean it's a passivity, like, oh, okay, fine, depressive thoughts, go ahead, make me miserable. It's not it at all, right? Because the moment you turn toward it, it's different. Say, huh, there you go, hello there, huh, okay, I see you, what's going on here? But you don't, we had a great discussion yesterday at the Sangha check-in where somebody said, you know, it's like your life is a concert, an orchestra, and your stress and your fear and all that are like, they're part of it, but you don't have to let them conduct. I love that. So on.
Thanks for this. This is very timely for me. I'll tell you what. I like what you said early in the talk about how stress and agitation and all that negatively affect your decision making. And so there were some decisions I needed to make about my life. I mean, a lot of things that cause stress, you can't just decide them away. You know, like I have some career threatening health problems that, you know, my voice is getting better, though that's really good. I had these indoor performances to do, and I'm going in my head about, well, I'm going to wear a mask and I'm telling people stay away from me, and you see, and I'm going to ask the bartender to open the door, and I'm going through, and it's just like, just cancel them, just cancel the indoor gigs. And so it's less money for me, less money. But I, as soon as I did that, it was like, ah, the stress just went away. So just making these decisions that I didn't want to make, it just took the opposition away. Mm-hmm. Not everybody gets to do that, but in some cases, there's just some decision that needs to be made that your body is just telling you, you need to address this, you know? And so the other thing I want to say was like an exercise that I do. Sometimes when I'm having like a full blown anxiety attack about this stuff, I can't sit zazen and not just get more wound up. Mm-hmm. So meditative walking really helps. And also just the silly thing that I do was I ask my feet, what do you think, feet? What do you think about this problem, feet? And what do they think? They don't think anything. So it's just about getting my energy, and walking is like that too. Just getting my energy physically, just getting it down in my body. And that really seems to help.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for sharing this. Those are beautiful. Oh, all right. Well, we're at 12:15. So, or wherever you are, we're at the end. Thank you all for being here. Let's say our closing verse. Arising in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay cool.
Take care.
Have a good week.